Liberty sees me, it stands by me, and celebrates me for who I am.
When I come into the office, I feel that I belong here.
I don't have to be corporate America Gabby. I can just bring Gabby to work.
Reach your potential and find a job you love at Liberty Mutual. We offer development training, rich benefits, and a culture that lets you bring your whole self to work so you can pursue your tomorrow today. Ready to consider a career at Liberty Mutual? Find out how at libertymutualcareers.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today, Chris, Andy, and Heath are interviewing Omar and Elizabeth Williams. We'll hear a little bit about their life and also their experience at Youth with a Mission.
Yes, that is the sound of Heath Dills, who has been living in a cave for God knows how long. Heath, where have you been?
I've been at work with this new work schedule.
See, when you come on and play the guitar for us, there's nothing except for maybe Omar's face, but podcast listeners can't see that. But besides that, you playing guitar on this podcast is probably one of my favorite things.
Drops the panties for sure.
Iconic. That's all it is. What you want? I mean,
the me undies are dropping right now.
Oh, I love it.
You wore the other day.
Omar, you can't talk yet.
Sorry.
All right. No, I'm really excited because we're usually talking to people that I don't really know personally, and technically I don't know you guys personally. I've met you through the BC Club and all that sort of stuff. But we're always doing podcasts with people that are very external to me that I'm learning about a week before a podcast, and I've never even heard of them before. But we get to talk to you guys tonight or today, whenever the listener listens to this, about your experience with YWAM, and I'm really excited about that. And so Elizabeth, Omar, thank you guys for coming on the Fade to Gray podcast, which you're hosts of.
Yay.
Welcome.
Can I talk now?
you definitely can talk now.
Well, thanks for having us, Andy. I just want to say right off the bat, Seth, thanks for having us on your podcast. Appreciate
yes,
it.
Yes, this lot. Is Seth's podcast. That's right. I love it. I'm really stoked because I don't know much about YWAM at all. So that's why, and to be honest, this is an opportunity for me to get to know you guys more too, I feel. So, yeah. and especially it gives the listener a deeper look at your marriage and where you're at now. And I feel like doing this is almost an honor in a way. And, yeah, it's cool. It's cool. So, like, where do we even start? Are we going back to when you first enlisted in YWAM? Is that what they call it?
Enlisted.
Is there an enlistment process?
Pretty much. I don't know.
There is an application you fill out. Yeah, but I don't know that you're turned away. The only time I've ever heard somebody not be turned away is if they don't have the money or they don't get a visa.
So. Oh wow. Now when you go to YWAM, do you get funded by people at like a local church or the church you go to or whatever, or do you actually pay out of pocket?
It's both. Both. So YWAM stands for Youth with a Mission, in case listeners don't know. And it was designed as a training course or a group of young people to be trained in mission work. But a guy named Lauren Cunningham started it in the 60s after a vision that he had of youth telling people about Jesus and crashing on the shores of the nations like waves to tell people about Jesus. And so he set up a bunch of different training courses, had a bunch of people join him in training, and they came up with all these different programs, schools that you can go through. When we were in it, it was in 150 countries around the world. They had bases in 150 countries. And the base that Omar and I just happened to be at the same time for our first program, the Discipleship Training School, or DTS, was Lakeside, Montana. And for me, my grandparents had saved up money from the time I was little for college education. And so I'm not sure if I disappointed them or not, but basically the money that they used for college, they had saved for me for college, I used for my YWAM training stuff.
And were they upset about that?
I'm not sure, because they had been missionaries themselves, and so it was like, we wanted you to go to college, but you're being a missionary, so should we be mad at you? I don't know. They never said anything to me about it, so I think they were okay with it.
Yeah, and if, you know, you can always pray for more college money, you can just pray for it.
Right.
And it'll, you know, it'll just come, it's fine.
Yeah. Is YWAM where you two met?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and we can definitely talk about YWAM, but for me, I don't have a whole lot to say about it. Master's Commission would be more of my story. The whole discipleship training program school thing, I spent damn near 2 decades being involved in or leading, so that's, I'm good with talking about that. But yes, YWAM is where me and Elizabeth officially met. That was our first year being Elizabeth, so that was fun. She was always Beth to everybody before that. But we never really got to know each other while we were there. It's a very small part of our story. But it's YWAM, or just the whole discipleship training schools, are an intriguing phenomenon to me. Something I once dedicated my whole life to for 2 decades. So
can we put a timeline on that? Like, how long ago are we talking when this all started?
2001.
April 2nd, 2001.
It was DTS.
And where were you guys in your lives that like led you to YWAM? What was going on in your lives that brought you to that point?
Who are you asking? Yeah.
Yeah.
Either. Elizabeth?
I had just finished high school. I was a little bit early. I was homeschooled, so I could finish up early. I turned 18 on March 4th, graduated sometime like March 15th or something, and took off for Montana on April 1st because school started on April 2nd.
And I was 21 years old at the time, dating a young lady. Well, I guess turning 21 in December, so I would have been 20. December. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Correct. Wow. Okay. Thanks, babe. I've been telling this story
for most of the year.
All right. So I was 20 at the time, dating a young lady who's, I don't know, 19, 18 years old, who had a 2-year-old son or 1-year-old turned 2 while we were there. Elizabeth, and get the dates correct for me.
He had a birthday while we were there.
Either way, I was way preoccupied with all of that, more than the school, honestly. Didn't really go there dating the girl. It was a very strange thing. She kind of followed me there, you could say. I didn't handle it well, and so my response was to start dating her. So that's where I was at in life. So 20 years old, I wanted to do something for Jesus. There was somebody else in the church that I went to that had gone to a YWAM in Hawaii, and it sounded intriguing. My family has like a missionary, pastor background, and, I had an uncle who encouraged me, heavily because I had a heart to want to travel. I just knew that, like, at that point in my life, I was basically just smoking weed and listening to the Grateful Dead. You know, I just wanted to basically be a deadhead. And my family was like, well, it's like, if you want to travel, then why don't you go to YWAM? And so the one that I picked was in Montana, and I was supposed to be able to go to Brazil on my.
Because you're thinking, at least I can smoke weed in Montana.
Well, not you're thinking 2001, man. It wasn't legal anywhere. But I mean, but the reason I picked Montana was because the outreach was to Brazil. That was the whole selling point to me, because I always wanted to go to Brazil, and I happened to get on the team. Because it's a 6-month program. 3 months you're in Montana or your base, and then the other 3 months you do an outreach. Well, my outreach, somebody didn't fill out their visa correctly, and we ended up in Northern Ireland instead of Brazil because you can get there without a visa. So,
my team went to Thailand.
Wow. So, did this person end up getting detached from your team?
No, I don't. They didn't tell us. They didn't tell us who. They just said somebody didn't fill their visa out right. Like, you know, basically, like, that's what we were told. Like, so we filled out all the paperwork, and we were trying to very careful about the wording and everything as we were trying to get into Brazil at that time. And then a couple weeks later or whatever, they were like, yeah.
Don't screw up. That's
what they told us. I mean, I don't know what really happened. But, I mean, it still was pretty awesome. Like, Northern Ireland was gorgeous. Like, it was amazing, probably better than I would expect it to be, but not where I thought I was going to end up when I signed up for month. But hey, I met Elizabeth, and you know, 4 kids later, here we are.
Amen.
It had to start somewhere.
So now, if Montana or that first beginning part was so insignificant to your story, where does it start to get significant?
Good question. Okay, so fast forward 7 years.
Wait, pause.
Okay.
Remember, it was 2001 that we were meeting each other. So Right. Think about the social media, such as it was, that was popular. You had MySpace and you had Instant Messenger.
That's right.
Instant Messenger. We all exchanged our Instant Messenger email handles or whatever they were back then.
And yeah. How many students were there? 40, 60 students total?
No, there were 32. Well, there were 32 at the beginning. There was 31 by the end, or 30 by the end, because 2 dropped out. 1 got kicked out. 1 dropped out. And then we all exchanged our email password, or email, whatever it was. And so then 7 years later, go Omar.
Yeah. So 7 years later, nobody really uses Messenger anymore, right? And, like, I check it very sparingly. I don't know. I think over that 7-year time period, I may have spoken to Elizabeth 3 times. Just being generous, my numbers. Yeah. I've been exaggerating my numbers tonight, so forgive me.
Yeah, 2 or 3 times. I was engaged to some dude at one point when he called, yeah, or messaged or texted. I don't remember how he got a hold of me, but
it was always just
saucy.
It was always just like not the right timing, and just like, okay, hi, bye, see you later type of thing. Like, just catch up real briefly. And then, because we never really had a real strong connection, I guess let's not skip over one of the stories of YWAM.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here's how you pick up a wife
on a clear summer night.
So the very first conversation that Elizabeth can remember having with me, that we can recall, was in the breakfast line. For the buffet, one of the mornings. See, breakfast was optional. Like, lunch and dinner, you pretty much had to be at, because you had, and breakfast was optional unless you were on the team that had to cook. So, it had to be one morning that I don't know what had a wild hair in me that I decided that I was going to eat breakfast, because normally I'd sleep in for as long as I possibly could. And I go there, I'm standing in line, and there's this attractive young lady in front of me, she, you know, turns around to say something. I'm not sure what. But as soon as she opens up her mouth, I have no filter now, but I mean, like, at 20 years old, I had
worse then.
Much, much less of a filter. And I was like, it's like, damn, your breath stinks. Or what did I say exactly, babe? Do you remember?
I don't remember. Something along the lines of your breath stinks, your breath reeks, something like that. And I was really horrified because it was the one morning I had decided to go to breakfast without brushing my teeth before I went. And that was the last breakfast I ever went to without brushing.
And you brush your teeth immediately when you wake up ever since, right?
Not anymore, no. He already has me, so.
That's right, that's right.
Now you're stuck.
Oh, that's yeah. Nasty, man. Yeah, so that was my pickup line, and, you know, it worked real well. But yeah, so anyway, we did, yeah, but we were just from two completely different worlds. And at that point, you know, coming from like that, you know, pseudo hippie Grateful Dead background thing for her, like that homeschool background, it's just, we're just in completely different circles. And maybe one other conversation, that we had briefly, about my father, maybe.
At the end of outreach, you come back to the base and you have like a debriefing week and a graduation at the end. And he had maybe just heard from or was trying to plan a meeting with his biological father for the first time. And we had a conversation about it, and that both of us like halfway remember the conversation and remember walking away going, oh, maybe there's more to this person than meets the eye, is kind of the impression we both got of each other, because we didn't hang out with each other during the school, really.
But that was really it. And then we exchanged all of the information with everybody. And then 7 years later, most of the people fell off and she's on, I'm on. And we start talking just about ministry stuff. I mean, the place I was at in my life 7 years after that point, the place she was at in her life, I don't think either one of us really were looking for or wanted anything to do with a relationship. I was just being friendly, honestly, and just, hey, you know, how's it going? And what she was doing at the time was very interesting to me. She was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and still with YWAM and, you know, doing music stuff down there, but also working with the First Nations people group, or the Native Americans down there.
We just made contact with some First Nations people near us, and we had been trying for years to reach out to them and see, is there anything we can help you with, or do you want to do any music together? And we finally found this couple. And so we had just gotten back from a trip from Arizona with these guys. And then Omar, like,
and then the program that I was in Master's Commission in Alaska, I guess had a pretty good reputation for our relations with the First Nations people group, and kind of just building relationship and going about it a different way. And so I was genuinely just wanting to, maybe like partner with and help her out. And it was just something that was a real passion of mine at the time, just building bridges and gaps of, like, you know, that people group. So anyway, so and then
my phone number so that he could give it to his
right after
director.
He told you about your crap breath.
No.
7 years later.
Seven years later. Instant message. Thing.
Yeah, I couldn't smell her breath anymore at that point.
Well, sometimes it lingers. Yeah. But no, he got my phone number to give it to his leader.
Yeah.
And a couple weeks later, he called me. A week later, he called me again. Day later, he called me again. Then we were talking every day. Our relationship went pretty fast, realistically. I mean, we reconnected in March. We were dating by, like, I don't know. I went to Brazil on a mission trip, and we started dating right after I got back. So I can't remember if that was May or June of that year. That was 2008. And then we both went on mission trips that summer. So he went down the Yukon River in Alaska and was ministering to the First Nations people along the river. And I went to China to play music. And then we came back, met up in Kansas in August. Do you want to say anything about that part?
You guys are like a movie.
It really is. She's going pretty quick. I don't know. About Kansas?
Yeah.
Or about... no, you keep going. You just keep going.
Okay, so...
I checked out a little bit. I'm sorry.
It's your story. You checked out of your own story?
No, he checked out of his wife.
We're definitely leaving that part in, by the way.
My voice just puts him to sleep, so it's all good.
No, it's not that. I really was trying to say something earlier, and then I forgot what I was going to try to say, and then you started talking, and then you asked me what I was going to say, and I'm like, you're talking. Just keep going.
Oh, okay. August happened. So in August, we met up in Kansas. So at the time, his grandma and one of my grandmas lived 20 minutes apart. And so we worked it out to go see our grandmas and ended up hanging out in person for the first time in 7 years.
Wow.
And that's when he asked me to marry him during that trip within the first day. I don't remember. And then we got married in December. And we were pretty much apart that whole span of time, except for that week in August.
Was that hard? And the week before
our wedding. Yes.
That's got to, I mean.
Thank God for technology.
Yeah. Are you guys Skyping and all that sort of stuff at that time? Is there just endless Skype calls?
Yep. Yeah, because it was all Skype
all night. Yeah.
Kind of awesome.
Wow. I don't know. I've only had one long distance relationship. So props to you guys. I mean, and Omar, the first day, dude, I just love you. Like, you are a total go-getter dude, but that just proved it even further.
You're a god.
He is. He's Omar the god.
So basically, that's the story. That's it in a nutshell. That's why I wanted you to tell it, baby, because I know that you would get all the way through it from start to finish without chasing rabbit trails and insignificant parts of the story, which is where I was still camped out back on one at the very beginning.
Wait, from DTS or back when we started talking?
Back when we started talking.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, it wasn't like I was really honestly wasn't interested in having a relationship with anybody at that point, because a lot of it was because of brainwashing and different things that was happening. I say brainwashing, I don't know. The purity culture was very strong in the school that I was in, and it was the third year that I was in the school, and we had just got done with the whole purity teaching that my director at the time was famous for. And so it was the third year that I heard it and first year that I started believing it, and was actually really excited about it and just telling Elizabeth all about it as we were talking and getting to know each other. It really wasn't until the whole, I prayed for her. She was going to go do like a suicide prevention hotline or something like that. I remember the first time I actually kind of like started liking you. Like, it was like,
that week was intense.
Yeah. And you were in. So like, I was just able to be there for you and kind of like, we shared some emotional stuff and I was able to pray over you. And I was like, hey, this, you know, we might be able to make a pretty good team after all. And then, we had some conversations. I think one of the things that really stood out was the fact that she said she was really excited. She's, I just got a brand new house. I'm so excited. And I'm like, huh? Well, I'm like, wow, she's got a lot of money. What's going on here? And then she shows me and it's like her suitcase. And I'm like, oh, okay. So she likes to travel a lot too. You know, she's kind of got that whole thing going for her. Honestly, guys, when I met Elizabeth, I so didn't trust myself in relationships that I had like at least three people that I respected, like in like religious circles, to green light my relationship so I didn't like sabotage my own life or something with like the women that I was attracted to at the time. So
yeah,
well, it's not even the women that I was attracted to. It's just that like, I don't know. I'm a lover, obviously, you know, I jump head first into everything.
Of me.
I do too. That's part of why our story is the way it is, because I've been engaged. I was engaged twice to two different guys before getting married to Omar. So
third time's the charm?
I mean, I guess so. Yes.
But I think the meat of like kind of our story really lies in like all of that. The fact that like there were so many different things that happened that I considered signs or things that God was doing, his hand was on our lives, like bringing us together,
where we moved our wedding up, you know, 3 months sooner than it was going to be when we got married on my birthday, because she had an opportunity to come to Alaska and do some work. And there was so many different like things that happened that just seemed like, you know, this is God. And so when the first few years of our marriage were rough and rocky, that was the thing that really, really kept us together more than anything, was that belief that, yeah, that, you know, we can't be wrong because God said, you know. And so, I mean, there was probably years where we probably shouldn't have been together. Like, it was pretty toxic for each other and for, you know, anybody that was around us, you know, but we were in ministry and we were, burning the candle at both ends. You know, she was on stage as much as the pastor was, and I was running a school while the director was, you know, MIA half the time. So
that was once we were in Alaska and married.
So anyway, so what do you guys want to know, I guess? So that was, she gave us the fast forward version of how we got married. I told you guys a little bit about the YWAM experience, but the can of worms is all in Alaska. What do you want to know?
And that's where Master's Commission happened. That's correct, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And were you married at this point?
Well, I mean, so he was a student first for 3 years in North Pole, Alaska. We got married, and then we moved to Wasilla, Alaska, Palmer, Wasilla, Alaska. We worked with a church from Wasilla, Alaska, after we were married. So Palmer, when we were in Palmer, we were with one ministry for drug and alcohol rehabilitation, and then we worked with Master's Commission in Wasilla. So
and we moved to Alaska, and we fast forwarded our wedding 3 months because she had a job opportunity with YWAM in Homer, Alaska.
That's right.
Which is why we got married on my birthday and went directly, like,
a week later
doing ministry with young people in Alaska, and never stopped until we left Alaska, like 5 years later.
Yeah, so it was Homer for 3 months, and then Palmer for 2.5 years, and Wasilla for 2.5 years. So by the time we got to Wasilla, we'd been married almost 3 years, ishly. Is that right? And yeah, it was Charlotte. Our second daughter was just born, and the church had this Bible school program, Master's Commission. They needed staff. They had just had a huge turnover in their staff. Their director had left. There was other church staff that had left. Some things were starting to go down, so the church was starting to lose momentum. And so they brought in a new director, and they brought in Omar and myself for staff. So that's...
Wow.
We walked into a shitstorm already before we even got to the shitstorm.
So I didn't know that you had actually done... I just thought Omar went through Master's Commission.
He did. He was the only one who was a student as Master's Commission. I was on staff.
Understood.
I was just on staff, and I never really considered myself part of the group. There were a few times I was like, I do not fit. And the pastor was like, why am I stupid? Like, Master's Commission's where it's at, and you didn't do Master's Commission. And I was like, oh, I get it.
So, now, when you're a student of Master's Commission in Homer, Alaska, what are they teaching you? What is the first step in a Master's Commission class? What is it all about?
Go ahead, Omar.
Thank you. The first step would be to abandon everything. Like, what does every cult teach you to do?
Right.
Don't talk to your family for 3 months. Get off of Facebook. Get off of everything, and just focus on God and only listen to the teachings that are happening here and the things that we deem are necessary or good for your spiritual being. Literally, the first whole year of your Master's Commission, you sign an agreement. Basically, you're not going to pursue any relationships. So that's off the board right away. And so you don't have to have that distraction of a boyfriend, girlfriend, or anything like that. And then, our school was pretty extreme. Like, that was the rule for the first year. But the second year students didn't do it either, obviously, or, you learned the first year that you didn't need it. So the second year, you don't pursue a relationship either. Literally that's abandon everything. That's what Master's Commission was all about. It was about servant leadership. And so it was Jesus came to serve. And so we're going to serve too. So we went to a lot of churches and stacked a lot of chairs. I mean, a day in the life of Master's Commission would be, wake up 5:30 in the morning, get some breakfast in you, be at prayer at 6 o'clock in the morning. In our Master's Commission, the prayer at 6 o'clock in the morning was a warfare prayer, which basically meant you walked around in circles in the sanctuary in the dark, praying out loud, basically declaring how your day is going to be, like declaring good things over the church, over the leadership, over the president, over, basically however you can fill time for an hour. And the more profound and spiritual you can sound, you're just praying out with a bunch of other like young people, So what is this like? I mean, how do you not get into that? I don't know. It's interesting.
Especially early in the morning.
I have many issues with that because I'm still. I mean, I did that shit for 3 years or more. I mean, I never was a morning person. Never. It didn't train me to like start waking up earlier. It's just
God didn't make you a morning person, did he?
That was my suffering for Christ.
I guess so. So it's just so funny because I picture Master's Commission as in like some group with like cool jackets that have like MC on them.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just going out and just blessing people. And it to me, it sounds like an elite group of Christians just blessing for Jesus. But it sounds like they're just like, hey, can we help you?
No, it's definitely a spiritual pride. Like we definitely have the coolest clothes. We definitely have the coolest logos. We definitely have the coolest, what are they called? Human videos. And like,
basically skits.
In fact, every year, once a year, and they had a conference where you can showcase like how cool your human videos are, or how progressive and hip your Master's Commission is with its outreach ministries. So that's the biggest thing Master's Commission was about outreach. It's the Master's Commission. Go and make disciples. Go and recreate, Jesus' model of, discipling, people. So that was the whole idea.
Would they come to you guys and say, hey, we've only won, 12 souls for Christ this month, guys. We're down 10 souls. What's going on?
No, but if we went on an outreach, we had to come back and, tell the numbers. The numbers were huge, because they want to know, where the money is being spent. So, if we go down the Yukon River for 3 weeks, we better come back and say how many, young people converted to Christ or did rededications or this, that, and the other, because you stand in front of the church, people who gave money to that, and you tell them what they just paid for,
Typical. Here's your return on investment.
Stuff. Yeah. Typical missionary stuff. All missionaries have to do it.
Now, forgive me for saying this in regards to Master's Commission, but couldn't you just lie and say, hey, we got 100 today?
Well, it's spiritual pride, right? So,
sure.
You get off on how righteous you can be. And so, you can't get away. The group is not going to lie. Individuals, if you can get away with it, yeah. But there's not going to be there was no conspiracy, to be able to not in our group at least. Could you do that? Yeah. Would it be a lot easier? Yeah, I guess if that's about the numbers, but it just frustrated us because there was a lot of young people that knew, and that's the thing about Master's Commission is, they help the church, but they hate the church. they were better than the church. The church is slowing us down. This is how this is supposed to be. We're supposed to be discipling people. And you guys are just sitting in pews doing nothing. What are you even doing here?
Oh, interesting. Wow, there was that kind of attitude prevalent there, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. So how far into it do you see, like, how far into it until you see something that makes your soul not sit right? What was the first thing that you saw, maybe from a leader's words or attitude or whatever? What was that first little tidbit that made you start second guessing, was this the right decision?
I felt like we were in the right place at the right time as far as staff, like joining staff. Mm-hmm. I definitely felt like we walked into a shitstorm. Like, you could tell, you walked in and everybody was just shattered. They were in the middle of their program and they just lost their director and one of their other staff girls. Or did April stayed with us until the end of that year? Either way, it was just a mess to begin with. But I felt the spiritual pride with our senior pastor right off the bat, because he's like, I don't know, Omar never saw it, but I always felt really out of the club because I had not done a master's commission. I was only a YWAMer, so I didn't really know what I was doing.
Yes, you said that.
Or like a lesser.
When you say that you walked into a shitstorm, you mentioned some people leaving. What happened before you guys got there? What did you walk into?
Basically, the senior pastor and the associate pastor, who was the master's Christian director, had differences of opinion on how to raise children, their own children. And so the associate pastor, who was the master's commission director, left. And the pastor was making some decisions in his preaching, too, that they didn't agree with as well. So nothing that we as bad Christians would think was terrible, but when you're in a denomination that believes certain things and you preach, hey, maybe this isn't the only way to think about this, some people get mad.
It's shattering stuff.
Shattering.
Well,
shattering.
It's biblical. There's some scriptures that say that in the end times, you know, they're going to distort scripture and they're going to be false prophets and all of that, which can be used manipulatively within church culture.
Shut other people down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But Omar, as a student, what do you think was that first thing, that first thing
right away
for you?
For me, it was right away. It was just the whole purity culture thing. I saw that from the very beginning. I'm like, what is this? Like, there were separate vans for guys and girls. Like, when church services would happen, like, all of the youth and of females would sit on one side of the church, and all of the youth and their guys would sit on the other side of the church. I mean, the lines were very strict, very, very, I mean, it was just weird to me. Like, for where I came from, like, I didn't understand that. Like most of my friends in high school, you know, were kind of like females, and I was raised by women. And so, like, I didn't have a whole lot of, real strong, like, guy friends when I was. And so I think that's a good thing that happened in Alaska. Like, a lot of that changed, but it was definitely strange from the beginning. I mean, there was other things, but that was the first thing.
Yeah, because it just seems like it seems like if you've never experienced you know, taking a different van because you're, you know, it's a van full of dudes and you gotta, you know, or sitting in church and, you know, they're afraid that you might touch each other. In church, it's like, what are you actually afraid of?
You question every thought. You start to think that everything that you do is sinful, and it makes you feel like a predator for everything. And that word was thrown around all the time. You know, like, are you a protector or you're a predator? You know, like, protectors act this way, predators act this way, you know? And so, and there was a whole list of, are you this, are you that? Are you a sucker fish? Or are you a king salmon? You know, these are like exact, I should show you. I could actually have the files. I can show you, like, I've taught this. God forgive me. I've taught this stuff to other people. But that's just one of the things. Another thing that was weird from the beginning is that like at least three times a year, we go through the John Brevere Undercover series, which basically is just submit to your leadership, even if your leadership isn't godly.
Isn't godly.
Yeah, as long as they're not telling you to do something that is a sin, then you should still submit to them. Because, I mean, that's what David did. David did that to Saul.
No. Right, but...
King Saul is throwing spears. I mean, your pastor's just talking bad about you, okay? He's just slandering your name. He's just taking stuff he knows and spreading it. I mean, this didn't happen to me. I'm just using it as an example. But he's not throwing spears at you. It could be worse. I mean, you're not David.
Right, and when they're bringing up those people's names, if they get called on it, it's, well, I'm just trying to keep them accountable. I'm just trying to make sure that, you know, God's glory is being shown. I don't want them to be a bad witness. That's all. I just, you know, I'm concerned, really.
I will say this as we keep going, and because it is, I do want to be careful because there were some people that, like, I really do and did, like, love. I haven't spoken to a lot of people in years. And, you know, like, and so some people, this might be like some of the first things of the year. And I do want to say that I believe everybody that was involved, especially in when I was a student, you know, like whether it be my director then or the staff leader, stuff like that, like did the best they could and did everything that they believed that like was right for them at the time. Like, they didn't know that they were messing people up or anything like that, or, you know, like screwing up heads, or like they didn't see the spiritual pride for what it was, you know, and that was the other, and I'll give, so that'd be the third thing I'd say that I saw as a red flag is how the community responded to, especially in Wasilla, our pastor and our church. Like everybody in the community is like, oh, that's the church that hurts people. And like, that's the church that like basically like hurt, like that's the word. I don't even know any other way to say it. But
for listeners, Elizabeth is violently shaking her head up and down. Yes, yes, yes. So
yeah.
And wow.
I was the worship leader at that church for 3 years, and I tried to join a worship leader encouragement group. Like all the worship leaders of the valley would get together like once a month or something. And basically they found out what church I was from, and I never heard when they were meeting or where after that. They were very concerned.
Wow. So nobody who was or maybe now is part of Master's Commission, if it's still a thing, they don't go to a church? They don't attend a church? Or is that like church for them?
Oh, we had to be at the church every time the doors were open.
Yeah. And so we would be there every Sunday. We'd be there every Wednesday. We'd be there every prayer meeting. Like, we'd be there to clean the church. We'd be there for everything.
But Omar, you had said that you guys viewed people in church as not doing enough.
Right.
So it sounds like...
We just looked down on them because they just... looked at church like as a funk, they just like a community to come to. As church, like they weren't spiritual enough. They weren't in it 24/7 hardcore at every meeting and stuff like that. And that's the way we were made to feel like. And we had like one baby, two babies, you know, young at the, you know, and so then Elizabeth's leading worship, and they still wanted us at every meeting, every church service, you know, like sometimes I was like, I want to, like, Elizabeth's going to be on stage, like, I have this baby. I'd rather just stay home and be with this baby. I'm going to go to church and be hanging out with a baby in the back of the church anyway. Like, what's the point? What are we doing here? But it's like, but I had to be there. I had to be seeing that I was there. And I think that had a lot more to do with our leadership's issues of like rejection and perception. And, you know, like if I wasn't there, then people could say, oh, Omar, you know, doesn't agree with, you know, Ed or whatever's going on. So.
So with all that tension with the kids and just the busyness of really ministry work, right? That's typically some of the busiest, craziest lifestyles and draining lifestyles I think that there is. So with all that, is it the busyness that kind of led you to to get away from that? What was the catalyst of maybe?
Oh, go ahead. Summer.
No, yeah.
Summer 2012 is when it all started cracking. Like, that was the summer we went fishing.
Started crack-a-lacking then, huh?
I think. Omar, what do you think? You're rubbing your eyes.
Oh, no, just to answer Andy's question, yeah, I guess summer 27, what was the catalyst, though? Like, I mean, I wouldn't say, I would say the catalyst for it all going down was when the board asked, or what's it called? The elders asked the board for help because the IRS was going to start seizing property because we were $100,000 in debt. Like, I think that was the catalyst for things happening, because that's when they stepped in and basically removed our senior pastor.
And that was February, March 2013.
Yeah. But what Elizabeth was speaking to, like, is true as well. I mean, go for it. I was actually going to write down what that marker were to answer the question, because I wasn't sure exactly where you're going. But I do agree that, like, for us, that was a very awakening experience. You're talking about the whole fishing trip?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you mean, if you want to tell that story, go ahead. But
just to say that there were other issues involved besides the senior pastor disagreeing with the denominational viewpoints. He was pretty clear on his change of viewpoints, because when you become a pastor at that denomination, you have to sign all kinds of papers and whatnot, but he started disagreeing, so it was that. But then there was other personal issues. I think Andy was hitting it on the head, though, with the pressures of all, like, having to be there and the expectations and everything. There were people involved and leaders involved that we all just started to crack, and that fishing trip, things happened that were not good. So then the elders, we had been losing congregants for so long. We were in debt hugely, and we owed back taxes hugely. And so the elders of the church went to the district. So the way the denomination is set up, you've got your pastors that are involved, that are the leaders of the church, with elders that kind of advise them within the church. And then you got the district, which is statewide or region-wide, to help you with advising. And so the elders went to the district and said, hey, we've got this huge debt. What do we do? So then they had to launch an investigation. And in the bylaws of the district, of the denomination, when a district goes in to investigate, the senior pastor has to be put on hiatus. And if their actions are found to be questionable, then they are removed, completely removed. And so that is what happened. And as a result of that, it was seen that our finances were completely in disarray, and our Bible school was attached to that. The Master's Commission was attached to the church financially, and we had nothing. We had, what, 30 students, and like three of them had paid for their school. Nobody else had paid anything. We were
That was a whole nother issue. Wow. For some reason, like, when you were talking about the senior pastor not agreeing with, you know, Assemblies of God doctrine anymore, the only reason that really mattered too was, and that's what I was thinking about. That was a good question, Andy. Like, what was the catalyst? Because looking back, there was, I think, like a bunch of different things just started happening all at the same time, honestly. Because Sarah Palin, that was when she was running for, like, vice president or whatever.
Yep.
And she had gone to our church when she was a teenager. It was her youth group. And then she had spoken actually at a Master's Commission graduation ceremony. And all that stuff was videotaped and could be found online. And so then our pastor and our church and everything became, like, famous for things that were said behind the pulpit because of Sarah Palin, and, like, look at Sarah Palin's crazy church. So we were Sarah Palin's crazy church back then. And so that was also, I think, a catalyst for just the microscope being on, like, the people involved even more, which was just more outside pressure, I think, that just kind of, like, catapulted everything to falling apart. And it was, you know, the district coming in, and then, and you can definitely tell that story, babe. I was not trying to tell you not to. I was just saying I'm not going to necessarily want. I don't know how much to say, guys, because basically the long and short of it, the school got shut down because the director had relapsed back into heroin.
And it started that July.
Yes. Well, is that when it started? Because he had...
Yes, Gina...
He was on medication for his liver. He had his liver disease. But see, if you know inside information, then that's...
I do, that's when it started.
So that's...
Well, you know, usually it's affairs or alcohol, but that's the first time I've heard heroin.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was new. It was different. It really explained a lot when I found out at the end of it all, because I was getting very weird, paranoid text messages at like 2 o'clock in the morning, threatening me to try to take over the school when all I did was like have the students do things during the day because he didn't show up. Like for scheduled events. And so, and I just would be like, okay, well, we're going to do this then today. And all the students would be like, yay, we had a great day. And then the news would get back that they had fun. And then he'd be like, you know, like, why are you trying to take over the student? I'm like, I wasn't, you know, and for me, my issues with rejection issues and trying to like, please like the men in my life, you know, daddy issues, whatever it might've been. God, that was hell. Like I literally didn't think it was him. I thought it was me. I was like, what am I doing wrong? Like I can't do anything right. So
now it got shut down while you were still living there, right?
Yes.
And they got the board. Am I saying that right? Is it the board or the district, whatever?
It was the board who is the district. The district has a board of people. And they shut us down. As far as they were concerned, it was the financial side of things. But then when they found out the other stuff going on with our assistant director or with our school director and his relapse, that just confirmed it. And they just put the nail in the coffin and that was it. And they called Omar and I in after the fact. And that conversation was really interesting because they're like, so what are you guys going to do? We're like, well, we just lost our house because our house is part of the Bible school program. So we got to find somewhere to live. And that was our job. So we got to find somewhere to work. And I was pregnant with my third child. And I don't think they knew that we actually lived on the campus because they were asking us, well, who else lives in this campus? And so we're like, well, the assistant director and his wife and five kids and us and our 2.5 kids and several married couples and all the students and a couple of single guys who are on staff with us. And they were like, oh, we didn't know that. Like, yeah, it would have been helpful if you'd known that before you shut us down. But it was good that we shut it down, I think, because financially we couldn't sustain us at all.
It almost sounds like you shut down the black hole on Stranger Things too. It just seems like you just closed it all up and it's like everyone's gonna be it's gonna be better now. Gonna be better now. And after it closes down, how much longer are you staying in Alaska?
Well, we ended up, so it was closed when, babe? In May, and they allowed us to stay until our son was born in October. And we actually pushed it a month later and just said, we left just before Thanksgiving. We moved down here Thanksgiving 2013. But the students had to be out within weeks of it being shut down. And the other staff had to be out by the end of the summer. So we got really, we lucked out on that one because I was pregnant.
That's right. You got kids. You're priority. That's right. Okay, well, so then you move straight to what? Straight to PA?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. We had a conversation. We were trying to decide because when everything first shut down, we were sitting there thinking, well, do we want to do more ministry? Like, that's what we got married to do, was do ministry. So Omar went down to Soldotna to talk to a pastor about starting their Bible school program, and it wasn't quite the right fit, and then I got a job offer for a worship leader position in Texas. And we looked at that and I was like, shit, you can make money doing this? Like, gotta be kidding me. And then that wasn't going to be a right fit though either. And the more we thought about it, the more we're like, you know, we are close with our grandparents. Like, I was close with mine and he is close with his. And our kids don't know their own grandparents. So let's move near them. So at the time, my grandparents had just moved in with my parents and their house was standing open. My dad had bought the house off of grandpa and dad's like, hey, look, if you need a place to stay, this house is standing open. If you want it, you can have it. And my grandparents were 10 years older than Omar's. So we figured rightly in the end that my grandparents would die first. So we're like, let's move there first and we'll stay there for 2 years and then we'll move to North Carolina. It's been 5 years, but we're still making plans to move to North Carolina. But my grandparents have both died in the last 3 years. So, wow. So it's, we moved back here to get real jobs and be real people and watch my grandparents die. So.
And now I assume that ministry not a part of your lives at all? Or do you see ministry like in a different way now, maybe not so.
I have no desire to do ministry ever again. I don't know. I like the idea of helping people and giving people advice. Obviously, mm-hmm. I do that. But no, I don't. No, because we tried. So we made a pact. We're like, we're never going to work for a church without being paid again, ever, because we weren't paid in this position in Alaska. So we moved down here. And we found a church and started going to it, and they needed a worship pastor. So I like did an interim worship leading thing for a minute, and it wasn't fun. And ended up going to a church plant and trying there, and it still wasn't fun. And I lost all desire, passion, everything for it. Omar told me, he's like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do ministry. I want to hang out with the kids. Although he ended up being roped into the youth, doing Bible study, or what was it, babe? Sunday school. For the youth. But we told the pastor, we will not do this unless we are paid, because we just weren't. And after a few years of that, it's been like 2 years now, I'm like, I'm done. I can't do the drama. I can't do the politics anymore. I want to play with people that I want to play with. So.
I mean, after all that, do you think all of those experiences in ministry, do you think that hurt your faith, or did it just reshape your faith in a different way?
I don't know. I'll let Omar answer that question. I'm not sure. I don't know. And the thing is, like, up until our own personal stuff started happening, like, I never blamed God for any of it. Like, it was just people being stupid and making bad decisions is how I always saw it. And yeah, I was angry and had major depression issues when we got back here to Pennsylvania. That was compounded by so many things. But I didn't lose faith in God at that point through all of that. Because to me, it was just people being stupid.
Yeah.
But Omar?
That's a hard question for me to answer. It's a good question. And for me to answer it honestly, it's hard because I don't know where I'm at. I personally feel that, that's just to answer the faith in God question. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to have... I can't go back, I guess, is the whole thing, as I'm ruined to have a, like, church experience ever again. Like, I think that there's good people in those buildings, but I feel like that there's just, it's a broken and corrupt system, and it just makes broken and corrupt people. And so... I mean, it happened to myself. I don't know. So, like, I still have faith in community because of you guys. is the most honest question I could give you. And that's the reason I paused for so long, because it's something that I've been reflecting on recently. So that's why I just don't, it's hard for me to articulate the words without getting too emotional, I guess. Because yes, I think God's real. Yes, I think he's bigger than like the four walls of the church. And I feel like I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing right now. Just having honest, real conversations with people. I think that's the most important thing that we can do. In any of it. And so, is God here? Is he with us? Yeah. I've been on this philosophical journey, I guess, and that's really been helping me kind of balance things. And if God's as real and as big as like we've always said he is in Christian churches, like he can handle this journey that I'm on, but I don't know. I don't know where it ends. I don't know where it comes out, but I feel like I'm right where I'm supposed to be. And it's scary because it's not where people have told me I'm supposed to be. You know what I mean? But that's big. And that's, I think, part of my story, you know, being damn near 40 years old and really living my own life for the last 5 years of my life. Up until that point, all the decisions to go to those discipleship programs and master's commission stuff seemed like it was good advice from people that I loved. And I was living up to somebody else's standards for decades of my life.
Even more so, you thought you were living up to God's standards. You thought you were like, I have to do this for God.
It wasn't even that. It was just always trying to impress. Like, I didn't want to disappoint, you know, the people that who believed in me. Like, I've always been told, you know, my whole life, you know, how special and how, you know, like you have a calling. Like I died when I was 2 years old, drowned, I've bought into all that bullshit. I bought into like, you know, like, you know, that like we've, our guests have talked about, you know, where you hear God's voice, you're special, you're anointed, you're going to change the world. I mean, all that. I think that we all have that in us, but you know, some people's personalities gravitate towards that more than others.
They do. And you are a natural leader. And I think that's why. I mean, I think you'd agree you are a leader. You are the one who actually got this podcast together. You saw everyone's talents, and that's a gift. So yeah, I could see how you would be susceptible to something like that. Dude, you guys are awesome. Thanks for coming on your own podcast and talking about these incredible experiences and detailing your love life. And now we know Elizabeth has stinky breath in the morning. She doesn't brush her teeth.
Yeah, that's true. It's worse now because I drink coffee. What's that, Heath?
This is great. I'm glad I was here for this. I love you guys. I loved spending the last weekend with you guys. It was awesome.
That was a lot of fun.
More about you. I'm so stoked to be you guys' friends, like for real.
Yeah, I love you, Heath. Appreciate that. Stuff.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can find Omar and Elizabeth's podcast on iTunes at Fade to Gray
Seth,
Podcast.
Seth's podcast.
And they are our co-hosts, of course. And again, you guys, thank you so much for doing this. This was awesome. And I know our listeners enjoyed this because I feel like you two especially get some of the most glaring reviews and comments I see on Facebook and on Marco Polo. Which, by the way, if you're not on our Marco Polo group, get on our Marco Polo group. Do it now.
It's on fire.
It is on fire. I mean, I think we have like 200 messages left every like hour or hour and a half
it's
or something.
It's crazy. It's so crazy.
These phones are going to blow up, man. And these people over at Marco Polo are going to have to find a way to keep up with all of our videos because it's next level.
It is. It's true.
It's been a lot of fun. And some of the conversations we've got into have just blown me away. Like I'm really amazed of what just that app has done just for relationships and just that face-to-face conversation. So
Marco Polo, pay me for my kind words. Thank you.
That's right.
Oh, that was a great conversation with Omar and Elizabeth. They came on their own podcast. I don't think anyone else can say that besides them. That was kind of amazing. Podcast inception. And now it's time for News for Noobs. Mason, hit the damn theme song.
I hear you get your news from CNN.
All these other fuckers watching Fox News again.
Yo, Chris, don't they know that that shit is whack?
Hell yeah, Andy, it ain't some white and black.
FTG fan, bam, we found another way.
News for Noobs, motherfucker, on Fade to Gray.
Holy shit, it is the News for Noobs. What's up, everybody? This is Chris.
Oh, hello. This is Andy. Welcome back. We heard good things and not so good things about the segment last week, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. A few people said that they thought we might be alt-right, but we want to set the record straight. Yeah, alt-right. Can you believe it? As if we were, you know, conservatives or something.
Yeah, not a big fan of conservatives. Not a big fan at all. That's why this week I want to talk about the migrant caravan.
The migrant caravan. I have heard about it. I'm actually like pretty concerned about this. I don't understand why we're shooting tear gas at them.
Well, it's because the U.S. government is a bunch of Nazis, and that's their prerogative. They hate children. They hate any non-white children. And I think it's really wrong. I think what they're doing is disgusting.
It's terrible.
Hold on, guys. What are you talking about?
Whoa! Who is that? Hello.
Hey, this is Lucas.
Lucas.
Oh, hello, Lucas. Who are you exactly?
Well, I'm a Mexican national. Are you talking about immigration stuff without talking to a Mexican?
We were.
Damn, you're right.
Chris, did you even check any of your privilege?
I didn't check my privilege. Fuck, I forgot. Damn.
Okay, Lucas, we will have to apologize after the show and take you out to dinner or do something. But Lucas, yeah, we were actually just catching up on the migrant caravan situation. Do you know anything about this?
I do. I'm very well informed, not only by fake news in the U.S., but actually, you know, like footage of my friends and family in Mexico that are seeing just this caravan moving through Mexico. So, yeah, I'm well informed about it.
Now, when you say fake news, you're talking about Fox, right? Of course.
Of course. Of course. That's even fake and Fox to start with the same letter.
Oh, wow. I never put that together.
Oh, man. You're right.
Wow. So you said your parents are still living in Mexico and they're basically on the trail or the path where the migrants are taking?
The caravan is pretty much going through all these major towns in Mexico to get here. Yeah, everybody knows in Mexico what's going on, and it's very problematic in the society that we live in, because as Mexicans, we have problems, you know. It's not like our government is good government. I mean, they don't even take care of their own citizens, so now we have more problems by just letting people in without any proper way of entering a country.
Wow, Lucas, that is crazy. But how are they even getting into Mexico? Is there any type of border patrol there, a wall, anything like that?
Well, there was a big kind of like a barrier between Guatemala and Mexico, but the caravan just got in through force. So they actually even beat Mexican authorities, and they're just in right now. And it's just kind of, you know, it doesn't make sense that this is happening right now.
So, no, I was just wondering, are they letting them come through? Is the Border Patrol encouraging it in a way, and some of them are getting assaulted in the process, or are they actually saying they're enforcing the immigration policy in Mexico?
No, they're not. They're just letting them in, and, you know, actually the government of Mexico just, you know, they're keeping them right now and actually offering asylum, but they don't want to stay in Mexico. They want to get to the U.S.
It'd be kind of weird if Mexico deported anybody. They don't deport people, do they?
Oh, yes, they do, sir. They enforce the same laws that the U.S. enforces.
Wait, but that's racist.
It's not racist. It's the law.
Wait, but But I thought just borders were racist, and I thought that Mexico didn't have a border.
Yeah, like when I travel around the world, the first thing they ask is my passport. And I have to, if I don't have a passport, I will be sent back.
That's true.
It's the law. I study in Mexico, and I study with a lot of foreigners, and they have to report to immigration laws every 3 months if they're staying there for more than a year. And they have to keep track of everything they do, where they live, where they work, and everything. If not, they will be deported back to whatever country they're coming from.
Well, I actually read about this whole caravan thing that they did deport people recently. Some of the people that tried to rush into the United States, I heard that they deported about 100 of them.
Yeah, they did. They did. I heard the same thing.
What do you think the issue is in Latin America? Why do people want to come here? Like, what is it about Latin America that's not working?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's just corruption. I know the government here is corrupt, but in Latin America, corruption is very, very like, you can see it, you can smell it, and you can actually feel it. So, and just lack of education, you know, like you have to read and you have to get informed. And as long as we have a big population where people are ignorant of whatever their surroundings, I mean, you're going to have tyrants always telling you how to live and what to do with your life. And, you know, and I think that's a big problem. So as long as we don't get educated in Latin America and to actually know the big government is bad for you, you will never be actually you will never have a good society where actually the society will prosper instead of the government.
So Lucas, not a big fan of the big gov. Let's just put it that way. Not a big fan.
Not a big fan. I don't believe in big government. So I believe in small government. And government, the only job of a government is to protect their citizens from enemies.
Migrants.
Inside the country and outside of the country. No migrants. And that's the thing. I want, you know, for us that want to come here legally, it's very hard for us to come here legally. And so it's not fair that people want to come here illegally and they get all the goodies instead of going to the proper channel, you know. So I believe that they should, you know, they should make it easier for people that want to come here legally and actually give something good to this country.
Well, let's, Lucas, leave off on one positive note here. What's one thing maybe we can improve on with our immigration policy specifically? What's maybe one thing you would like to see change?
I would like to see change. And if you need laborers to work in your companies, I think you should bring them here legally and never abuse them. So that will be easy to fix. And if you get rid of the welfare program here, to be honest, if how is the people are still coming here and getting jobs, but people are on welfare programs where they don't work and they take advantage of those programs. So if you get rid of one of those programs, you will actually force people to work. So if you want labor or, you know, from other countries, you should offer that like an opening, you know, system where they can actually come and work for a certain time and then send them back. And if they need more workers, they should, you know, bring them here legally. And if they don't follow those companies, if they keep hiring illegally people, they should be penalized. And those are big corporations that never always get away with those things. So I think that will easily be solving the problem of immigration. I don't think the world will do it. I think it's going to be more like who's hiring these people and who is behind all of this. So easy to solve. Get rid of the welfare program. And then if you need people to work for you, you need to actually hire them legally. And it should be an easy way for them to get a job here.
It was a pleasure, Lucas. Thank you so much for coming on News for Noobs. It has been very fun.
Yes, sir. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you guys. Gracias, compañeros. Que tengan una excelente noche. Y que Dios los bendiga.
Igualmente, cabrón.
Adiós.
All right, guys. Well, welcome. Welcome again to the Movies That Molded Me. Today, we are going to be talking about Napoleon Dynamite. better known as Napoleon Dynamite.
Gosh, filmed, get it right, freaking retard.
Want some tots? filmed in or released in 2004, directed by Jared Hess, John Heider's first movie. Let's see, it was definitely a movie of its own, that's for sure. We put it in its own category. Let's see. How old, you can probably actually think, just saying Napoleon Dynamite probably brings you back right now to wherever you're sitting, whether it was at the movie theater, we left very confused, or at home, or maybe you're a little bit more prepared and probably like laughed your ass off at some very, very dry humor. But myself in 2004 was still in doing cult life and Alaska, so I did not go to the movie theater. I don't even know if it was released in Alaska theaters.
Hashtag cult life.
Hashtag cult life. The good.
I wonder
good
what you would find under that hashtag.
Storing up treasures in heaven.
So you were still in cult life.
Yeah, 2004. I was 24 years old. So I probably actually saw the movie like a year or two later, if I had to guess, and it was. Yeah, like very heavily involved the church I was going to and working with and working for. We had very strict rules on purity culture, this, that, and the other. And in the movies that you watch, like you might want to call it even holiness culture. But somehow or another, the clean humor of Napoleon Dynamite made it through. I mean, it might have been a little racy with, you know.
Speaking of racy, how did they feel about Kip and LaFonda's interracial relationship?
Or even the boob supplements that Uncle Rico is selling to the high school students. I rewatched it earlier today, but no, there was no foul language and stuff for those who are, you know, if you have young kids. I actually just finished watching it with my all four of my children, the 9-year-old, 7, 5, and 3-year-old.
Had they ever seen it before?
Never.
Oh, did they like it?
You know, they did. The older ones obviously liked it better, but the dance scenes at the end won over the entire crowd. So.
Well, let me just say it was a rough time for anyone with curly hair because you couldn't go anywhere. You could not go anywhere without being called Napoleon Dynamite. I had glasses, but they did not even somewhat resemble Napoleon Dynamite's. But it was just because I had curly hair that I would get called that all the time at school, at church. I remember one time I was at a youth group and it was probably my senior year and I had been called Napoleon Dynamite, I don't know, 16,000 times. And I was walking out, it was after service, probably July, mid-July, is probably 85 degrees when we walked out. And some kid walks up to me and I only did this because he was smaller than me. And he runs up, he says, "Hey, Napoleon, where's Tina?" Or he said, "Where's another character?" So my fist went back and I decked him in the foyer at church. So Napoleon Dynamite ruined my life. And I'm just going to go on record to say I will not be voting for Pedro.
was it the Ron Kwon Do? Ron Kwon Do is what you learned self-defense with?
Yeah, that was my training. That was my everything. That was my dance training. That was my life training. I learned how to take care of animals with, you know, him and Tina. I
thought Did it was Rex a, teach you self-defense?
Yeah, and that's how I learned to throw pigskin.
Well, Kip was training to be the cage fighter, you know, so...
You know, that's right. Chris, how old were you in 2004 and did you go to the theaters to see it or did you stay at home and rent it from Blockbuster?
I was 21 years old and my friends and I did go to see it in the theaters. At this time I was a very serious person and did not really get it the first time I saw it. No. I, of course, laughed at a few parts, but just thought it was ridiculous. And I don't know. I wasn't really into that kind of humor at the time, I suppose. It wasn't until I saw it about a year later on DVD or home video. I can't remember what it was. And laughed out loud at almost every scene. So I guess I was just in a weird place the first time I saw it, but certainly garnered a huge appreciation for it afterwards, so much so that I even own it today. So, I mean, I could easily watch it whenever I feel like watching it, because it's definitely a movie you can watch over and over and over again.
I feel like it's also a movie that's more enjoyable at home or watching with friends for some reason. It definitely probably did better with DVD sales, I would think, and movie tickets.
It was so weird that you almost didn't want to laugh in front of people that you didn't know that well if you were watching it with them, because it was so weird. Like, oh, if I laugh, I'm going to look like I enjoy this really weird, awkward scene. But it's like, yeah, it's a movie. That's what it's supposed to be funny. Like, and to me, even though, you know, Seinfeld is a really popular show, to me, that's kind of like what Seinfeld was for me. With, you know, I'm only 30, but anytime I was in high school and I was making a Seinfeld reference, and I would be like, right? Right? And it was almost like that with Napoleon Dynamite at first. Like, you didn't want to make a reference around people that you weren't sure were maybe Napoleon Dynamite fans. But once you heard a reference like, God, Tina, you fat lord, you opened up and you're like, oh, yes, a Napoleon Dynamite fan. But yeah, of course.
Are you drinking 2% because you think you're fat?
And looking back now, like, of course it's a cult classic. Like, that of that, you know, 2004, that decade, 2000 to 2010, that was at least top five for sure.
Well, it's just so different than anything you've ever seen or expected to see. And like, even like down to like the wardrobe was just spot on with like Napoleon shirts, wearing those big puffy boots. And I mean, my kids, the first thing they say is like, why aren't his eyes open? and so then we had to explain to him, like, it's just part of his character. It's just part of the joke. He just walks around with his eyes like half open all the time.
And I think one thing to remember is that this movie came out the same year as The Passion of the Christ. So for me, wow. You know, it just wasn't really time for a jokey movie. It was all about being serious. And I think the church rented out the theater for that. So,
yeah. Now that you hate God, you're like, wow, we need Napoleon Dynamite too. Cool.
Guys. Well, yeah,
that was awesome. I love it.
Yeah, appreciate you guys being on, man. It was definitely a movie that molded me, like, even though it was much later in life. And rewatching it with my kids, it was very clean. A few, you know, boob references is about as dirty as it gets. I will say, you know, the scene where the cow gets shot in front of all the kids in the school bus is still one of my favorite scenes. And so if your kids haven't seen anything like that before, like, you might want to warn them.
Right. Having said all that, if you want to watch this with your kids and get back to us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, that would be funny to hear kids' reactions, you know, in 2018 to Napoleon Dynamite. it's either you get it or you don't. And
has Avery seen the movie?
No, I'm afraid to show her.
Why?
Because she's going to say, Daddy, that's you. You know what? Hey, he's a good looking dude in real life. That guy is actually not bad looking. So it's like, hey, all right. But you know, they're not referring to John, they're referring to Napoleon. And yeah, hey, I guess in 2004 to 2000 probably eight, I definitely had the fro of Mr. Dynamite. And it looks dynamite. I'll just go on the record saying that. So
dynamite. Well, I will say too, just lastly, when you watch the movie or rewatch it, for those who just listen to this, you're like, oh, I got to watch that movie again. Don't forget, after the credits, one of the best scenes is like the secret scene at the end, the wedding scene. And so for those who have not seen Napoleon, for, oh my God, I mean, this whole thing was spoilers, but
now were they singing a song at the end?
Yeah, I think Chris sings it best.
I love technology.
Chris, close us out with the song.
Not
I think it's great.
As much as you see, always and forever. Something like that. I can't
always
remember.
Always and forever. Yeah, Kip was great.
Oh, we got to rate it on the grayscale.
On the grayscale, it's like a 1 to 5 on the grayscale. All right. I'm going to go with a 3.9. Giving that it's a you know, 2004. Actually, I'm actually going to give it another 0.6 and round and go up to 4.5 on the grayscale for myself.
Wow. Coincidentally, that's more than Siskel and Ebert gave it.
I'm sure. Well, you know, I felt like I was a little harsh in the 3.9, and I couldn't justify where that extra 0.5 or 6 was coming from. So I went ahead and just gave it.
I'm gonna go on record saying 2.7.
Wow.
Andy's a little tough on that grayscale.
Well, only because it scarred me emotionally, people. Okay, it's been hard. I've made it clear. It's been a rough ride thanks to this movie.
I give it 4 stars on the grayscale. This movie is hilarious and everyone should watch it. It's not a 5-star movie. It's not supposed to be a 5-star movie. It is every bit of a 4-star movie and it's great.
It's a perfect go-to rainy day movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if it's 3 p.m. and you're Omar and you had a cocktail and it's like, you know what? It's raining outside and I'm going to watch a movie. I'm putting on Napoleon Dynamite. I love you, Omar. Good stuff. I'm so looking forward to this segment. I love it. And I'm so glad that I only gave it 2 stars.
It's all right. We forgive you. There always has to be one hater in the group, I guess, you know, to kind of balance the scales a bit.
I think it's John Hader, right?
I do look like John Hader. Exactly. Good. You beat me to it.
So thanks for joining us on Movies That Molded Me.
That's it for today, guys. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow on Twitter, and join us on Marco Polo. Next week, Brian and Amira Weller will be talking to us about their experience growing up overseas as the children of missionaries.